Last week, we looked closely at some of the words of Slichos, and now we'll have a chance to begin to move on to Rosh Hashanah and the tefillos that we'll be saying Yirtzeh Hashem next week. We touched briefly upon the core theme of the day as it finds itself in the Machzor, and that is Malchus, the kingship of HaKadosh Baruch Hu that's established or reestablished and reinforced on the Yom HaDin, and it's the cornerstone of the all-important Musaf of Rosh Hashanah. Chazal described that Hashem instructs us, as it were, to Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, Imru lufanai Malchus, kidei shetamlichuni alechem. Say before me, recite Malchus in order that you should crown me upon you. Now, this is critical to what the day is about. It's ironic almost that we call it the Yom HaDin, but it's not really what Hashem wants us to be preoccupied with on Rosh Hashanah, at least not entirely. Maybe prior in Elul and following Rosh Hashanah during the Aseres Mitzvah, but over the course of Rosh Hashanah, yes, the judgment is there and it's real, but it remains in our consciousness, but to a great extent, almost in the background. We don't focus on Averos. We don't focus on tshuva in the classic sense, vidoy, charata, kabbalah, al-asid, clapping al-chait, apologizing and regretting what we've done. Here's an example, Avinu Malkeinu. We say it the entire Aseres Mitzvah, and it begins with the line, Avinu Malkeinu, chatanu lefanecha, we sinned before you. Yet, this is brought down in the poskim, many have the custom to leave out that first line on Rosh Hashanah specifically, so as the Averos and Tshuva are not the focal point, as we mentioned, the Malchus instead, Avinu Malkeinu, but not the Chatanu Lefanecha. There's so many examples of where the Malchus of Hashem comes to the forefront. There are many times where we may not even notice that it's there. Let's mention a few. More familiar, Rav Sadia Gaon's classic enumeration of 10 symbolic meanings of the shofar. First and foremost, number one, is the coronation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu through the sound of a shofar or a trumpet that would be blown when a new king is brought before his nation. But it's ubiquitous. In places, like I said, you may not have noticed, there's a widespread minhag, of course, to say Tashlich on the first day of Rosh Hashanah. This year, first day is Shabbos, so we postpone it to the second day or wherever you happen to be. If Tashlich is a big community event without social distancing, maybe you can reschedule it. But why do we go to the water? To feed the fish and the ducks? That's not the best idea for Yantif from a halacha perspective. And there are many reasons. The most obvious reason, obvious, of course, is that the central pasuk in Tashlich, and really the essence of Tashlich, comes from Sefer Micha. And the conclusion is V'sashlich b'mtzulos yam kol chatosam. All of their sins, all the sins of Klal Yisrael, should be cast to the depths of the sea. But there are other significant symbols of the water where Tashlich takes place. Not the least of which is cited by the Matzah Ephraim, classic halachic work on the Yom Narayim, and he explains that the water represents the way in which Klal Yisrael specifically anoints our kings. The Gemara in Horios, the Gemara in Christos tell us that a new king is always anointed by a river as a siman tov that his malchus should continue to flow like the water does, and continue to flow with his descendants from the Davidic line. Go back to Sefer Malachim. David HaMelech, right before his death, instructs Nasan HaNavi to anoint his son Shlomo to be the new king, and Shlomo is taken down to the Gihon spring near Har HaBayis, and that is where he's coronated. Something new to think about during Tashlich, we come to the water to connect with the coronation of Melech Malchei HaMelechim. And finally, one more example, the most obvious, as we mentioned last week, the tefillos themselves are transformed to reflect this central Malchus motif. We don't conclude as usual, as we would on other Yom Tovim, Mekadesh Yisrael Vazmanim, in the bracha of Kedushas Hayom. Rather, the day itself is defined differently. Yes, it's Yom HaZikaron, but we cannot simply conclude that bracha without also incorporating this same concept. And so we add Melech Al Kol HaAretz Mekadesh Yisrael B'Yom HaZikaron. It gets to the essence of the Kedushas Hayom, the very definition of the day. So with that background, it's very important for us to flesh out in the most down-to-earth way possible, what does this mean for us? Kabbalah's Omal HaShemayim, we do it every day. That's what Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad is about. And that's why Shema actually finds its way into Malchus in the Musaf on Rosh Hashanah. On one level, correct, it refers to Hashem's authority, his mastery, and the subservience to his will like any other king. Last week, we stressed also that includes Hashem's ownership or control of all blessing and goodness. But this week, let's try to explore B'siyata D'Shemaya, two new dimensions that emerge from sources that are perhaps roads less traveled in understanding Malchus. Let's start with Animam. The Rambam gave us 13 principles of faith. As in other areas, many contested the Rambam's prescription. In this case, not necessarily in content, but in the Rambam's presentation. The Sefer Ikrim questions, why do we need 13? Why do we need 13? If we want, we can squeeze them into three, simplify them, condense them, make it easier to remember. What are those three? Belief in Hashem, Torah min Hashamayim, and reward and punishment. That can encompass all 13. Here's an example. The Rambam's number 4, Animamin Bemuna Shalema, Shehu Rishon Vehu Acharon. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is first, and he's last. In other words, he's eternal, everlasting. His existence transcends time. He created time. Rav Yosef Albo, the author of the Sefer Ikrim, he says that this idea can really be subsumed together with other principles under the belief in the existence of Hashem, the first one that he enumerated, because that belief in existence of Hashem is really an umbrella for all the details of Hashem's unique identity, including his nitzias, including that aspect of eternality. And then he says something fascinating. Once he establishes those three main concepts, he goes on to explain that Chazal formulated the three special brachos of Rosh Hashanah to parallel those three beliefs. The first, existence of Hashem, and all that we know about him, corresponds to the bracha, as you might have guessed, the bracha of Malchus. What does that mean? What does that mean? How do we connect the belief of Nitzchias to Malchus, Hashem's eternity and Hashem's kingship? What we're saying is that when we recite the bracha of Malchus, when we follow what we're instructed over the course of the entire yontif, not just during davening, but the entire yontif to concentrate, even at Tashlich, our minds on being Mamlech Hashem, one facet of his kingship, one stone in his crown, one gem in his crown, is also to contemplate that God spans all of history, Haya Hove V'yeh. And you know, we say that all the time. We're very familiar with this notion. It's Adon Olam. Adon Olam Asher Molach B'Terem Kol Yitzir Nivra. The master of the universe, Asher Molach. He was king before anything was created. Again, king before Hu Rishon, Le'is Naso B'Chefzo Kol Azai Melech Shmonikra, as his will was realized and actualized, then he was also referred to as the king. V'hu Haya V'hu Hoveh V'hu Yeh B'Sefarah. In the Pismon, in the poetry that refers to Hashem as our Melech, as soon as we wake up in the morning, we begin davening Adon Olam, the Malchus is associated with this quality of Nitzchis, of Hashem's eternity, Hu Rishon V'hu Acharon. Hashem is forever. What does that mean in a practical sense? What does it mean to identify Hashem's Malchus with his quality of being eternal? So it means that Hashem's perspective is a perspective of forever. Our lives are but a short little blip in the very big picture of history, and we only see what's in front of us. We can't always discern the master plan we know exists, why things happen, as difficult and frustrating as that often is, but it's because our vision is so limited, that's all we can see. I had a Talmud here in Yeshiva, a guy with real strong belief in Hashem's involvement in his life. I remember him telling me that he grew up in a family that never had that much money and brought certain challenges, as you can imagine, but at this only tender age of 20, he was so thankful to Hashem because in retrospect, he understood that it forced him to work hard, to seek ways to earn and provide for himself, even at a young age when many of his friends had the luxury not to have to do that. He developed a strong work ethic to the extent that he literally put himself through college pretty much without any help, driven by an appreciation that HaKadosh Baruch Hu dealt him a hand that was meant in the big picture to help him grow, even if at times it was tough. He used an expression, which I'll never forget. He said, Hashem has a wide-angle lens. We have narrow vision. We have a narrow lens, but Hashem has a wide-angle lens across each of our lifetimes, across generations, centuries, and millennia. Chavetz Chaim gave a beautiful mashal. He said it's like a person who visits a shul in a neighborhood where that he's never been to, and he comes in, and he starts asking the guy all kinds of questions. How come you gave this guy the first lay? How come you gave that guy the second lay? How come you gave him the master? How come you asked him why did you choose him? So the guy said to him, well, if you were here last week, you know that the other guy got most of. The other guy was the Kohen we chose for the Aliyah. And if you were here more than just 1 week, you're not going to be here next week either. But if you had a perspective that spanned beyond the one Shabbos, the few hours you're sitting in shul, you'd understand why we made the decision that we made. And the same is true in this new dimension of Malchus that we're describing. Hashem's kingship over everything even is a rulership over time and transcends time. Rosh Hashanah calls upon us to reflect in a practical way on events, occasions in our lives that we didn't fully understand, and maybe go back and revisit them. Some of them, we can already look back and see how Hashem was directing things with certain outcomes in mind that might not have been apparent at that moment. An example which I feel is easy to put our finger on, perhaps we've undergone personal difficulties, only to find out later that we were uniquely prepared to help someone else down the road facing that same challenge. At other occasions, that may seem unresolved. But to those, we have to consider Hashem's wide-angled lens, and that the Melech, because Melech equals Nitzchius, eternality, has a bigger picture in store that's yet to be revealed. There's a story that always comes to mind. It's been widely published, but I'll read you one account. And the story is about Rav Yosef Kahaneman, the Panovich Rav. And the Panovich Rav traveled all over the world, literally, following World War II, to raise money for his fledgling yeshiva in Bnei Brak, where he lived, the Panovich Yeshiva. And on one occasion, he was visiting Rome, and his acquaintance, Rav Moshe Rothschild, who traveled with him, had arrived earlier, but the Panovich Rav got to Rome late at night when Dr. Rothschild was already there. He checked into his hotel, and he called Dr. Rothschild on the phone. Rav Moshe, you got to come right away. We need to go somewhere immediately. I've never been to Rome before. We're here, and I need to leave. Come to my hotel right away. Dr. Rothschild protested. He said, do you know the weather? Do you know what the weather looks like outside? It's pouring. It's late at night. You just got off the plane. Take a break. Rest. We'll go in the morning. He said, no, we must go right away. He said, okay. Didn't even know where he was going. He called the taxi and showed up at the hotel where the Panovich Rav was staying. Gets in the taxi. Driver asked where we're going, and he said, take me to the Arch of Titus. They got to the Arch of Titus, and it's a dark and stormy night. The Panovich Rav comes out of the car. He looks up at the relief of the triumphant Roman army marching back from Yerushalayim with the spoils of war, with the kelim from the Beis HaMikdash, most famous, the menorah that's etched in the Arch of Titus. And he looks up and he says, evil Titus, look closely. Take a good look at me. We are still here. Titus, Mir Zenenda, we're right. Where are you? Abu Bista, where are you? We're right here. Where are you? The Jewish people are still here, and you're gone. Your glorious empire, and you thought you'd rule the world forever, the Jewish people are still flourishing. And where are you? It's a very powerful, moving story. Perhaps, you know, it's important to emphasize that we don't want to take an ounce of the tragedy, one iota, away from the terrible chapters in our history, such as the Holocaust. But when we look 50, 60, 70 years forward, and we see a flourishing homeland that we've returned to, the only nation in all of history to ever be beaten and oppressed and exiled and ultimately come back thousands of years later, there's a redeeming irony that the Panovich Rav, in the chutzpah, so to speak, to Titus, was trying to bring out. And it comes with a realization, and it hopes also engenders a realization, this notion of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Malchus is a nitzchus that requires us to look through this wide-angled lens, not just to see the tragedy at the moment that it's happening. We need to experience it and suffer and even mourn for it, but to be able to also look ahead and know that it fits as a puzzle piece into a much larger picture. The story also resonates with me because I had my own almost Panovich Rav moment, you could say, on my own travels. A number of summers ago, my wife had a conference in Geneva, and on the way to Switzerland, we had occasion to spend Shabbos and a few days in Vienna. Why Vienna? So I grabbed the opportunity to have our stop over there because my grandfather, my father's father, is from Vienna, and he ran away before the war as a teenager, ultimately made it to Canada, and during the war years, spent much of the time in Canada until he was able to come to the United States, where he was reunited with his family and was married in New York in the 40s. And maybe 50 years after my grandfather had escaped Europe, he went back with my parents to see his school. He actually spoke from the window down to the street with a woman who was living in the apartment that he grew up with, that he grew up in. I saw the video, and taking with us some still shots that my family, my parents had taken, my wife and I went to try to find those same locations. And while we weren't successful, we visited the Jewish Heritage Museum in Vienna and learned a lot and spent Shabbos there. as I mentioned, in one of the shuls, a shtibach, one of the shtibach that, for all you know, my grandfather might have davened there as a bar mitzvah. It wasn't so far from where he lived. And on the one hand, I didn't know anyone in the community, but the small Jewish world that it is, before long, I was introduced to someone whose son married a woman from Rabbi Willie's shul in Riverdale, another person who as a teenager learned in Torah Vadas and used to come to Washington Heights to hear Soloveitchik give his famous Yorshayit drushes in the 60s and 70s. Nefesh HaRav, one of Rav Schechter's biographical works about the Soloveitchik, was on the shelf in the Beis Medrash. It was a big surprise, but I almost felt at home. And after a little schmoozing, when they discovered that I was a Rebbe in YU, they asked me to speak at Shal Shuris. And I did. And as I concluded the Divrei Torah, I became a little emotional and a little choked up because I felt like the Panovich Rav. I was standing maybe within the same small radius of where my grandfather grew up, was forced to escape the Nazis and coming back with revenge, as it were, to say Dvar Torah in Vienna once again 70 years later. And that helps again encourage us to see this bigger picture that the Malchus of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is meant to inspire us to feel and attempt, at least to hope, to better appreciate over the course of history and over the course of our lives. Just to conclude this piece, Rav Avram Chaim Levin, Rosh Hashiva of Tells in Chicago, passed away a couple years ago, says this is what we demarcate in Oz Yashar at the very end. Hashem Yimloch Le'olam Vo'ed, Hashem will be the king, he will rule. In parentheses, we don't say it, but in parentheses, some people do. In the Targum, in the translation of Aramaic of that Pasuk, we say, Malchusei Ka'im La'olam Le'olam. Kadosh Baruch Hu's Malchus is right now eternal. Because even though Oz Yashar, as Rashi tells us in Beshalach, is a song of the future, we, through our Shema Yisrael, appreciate at this moment the Malchus of Kadosh Baruch Hu, its eternality, and how that's an expression of Hashem Yimloch Li'olam Vo'ed and his Malchus at this very moment. This contrast between appreciating Hashem's Malchus one day as opposed to knowing it right now and bringing it out on Rosh Hashanah through Malchus, it's an excellent segue to the second dimension of Malchus that hopefully we can bring into focus in a practical way this evening. What we've done, and truly what the Yom Noraim Tfilos formulate, is that the world population is really divided into two parts. There are those that recognize Hashem as Malchus, and those that haven't yet. In the future, they will. In the future, they will. But for the moment, Imru l'fanei Malchus k'deisha tamlichuni aleichem, accept Hashem's kingship on ourselves. That's the major thrust of Malchus, but it goes beyond the believing religious Jews and extends to the rest of the world. V'simloch ato Hashem levadecha al kol ma'asecha. That's something we say in every single Shemona Esrei of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. Let me try to illustrate this. We mourn the Beis HaMikdash. We mourn its destruction, and it's a major part of our religious observance, not just on Tisha B'Av, but through the entire year in ways we may not even realize. One of my favorite examples is the fact that we say Shir HaMaalos on Shabbos. Why? Why do we do that? The Shulah tells us that a person has to recall that there is no temple. He has to recall it every single meal. And the way to do that is with the dirge of found in Tehillim, Al Naros Bavel. Every single day, at every meal, when you bench, Al Naros Bavel. It's in the bencher. Again, something that not everybody says. But the imagery of Al Naros Bavel is so depressing that for the special day of Shabbos, we have to recite a more hopeful prophecy of returning, rebuilding Beis HaMikdash, and that's what Shir HaMaalos is. Very few people say Al Naros Bavel, but we also say Shir HaMaalos, when in reality, Shir HaMaalos is the plan B, so to speak, because we can't say Al Naros Bavel on Shabbos. Almost every holiday, many mitzvos, even the way that we're supposed to construct our homes, we incorporate Zechel Mikdash. So what are we mourning? Beis HaMikdash, we have to reflect upon. It wasn't just a big shul, not even a very big shul, with a lot of members. Beis HaMikdash was something entirely different. Beis HaMikdash was a worldwide central broadcasting station for a message that there's a tangible presence of the creator of the universe that anyone can come and witness themselves. And they did, people did. Jews and non-Jews from all over the globe came to watch the miracles that would take place on a daily basis and feel the Shekhinah in a way that perhaps, hopefully, we can taste maybe briefly to a small degree when we stand by the Kotel and daven. True, not everyone liked the Jews all the time. And we may have obscured the experience I'm trying to describe at times due to our averus during history, but it was still a place where anyone who asked, if there is a God, where is he? And that person could come away no longer bothered by that question. The Ramah tells us that even Plato had a similar experience when he visited the Kotel and had a conversation with Yirmiyahu HaNavi at that very place following the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Okay, so what? So what about that? Are we in the business of a sound and light show to wow the nations of the world, rebuild the Beis HaMikdash, and show everyone what we've got? But we don't try to convert non-Jews, right? So what are we missing? The answer is, please listen carefully, when Hashem's presence is so remarkably evident and so obviously felt by all, there's a clarity of purpose and truth in the world. And that clarity is what we yearn for on so many levels, Zecher HaMikdash. Imagine a world for a moment where everyone, undisputed, knew and knows and will know that there's a God who loves the Jews and gave them the Torah. What would the Middle East look like now? We wouldn't be plagued by terrorism or any existential threats to Israel. It would be so clear who belongs there. Anti-Semitism, non-existent. Universal respect for the Jews by all nations would be an acknowledgement of Hashem's majesty and choice of the Jews to be Mamlechas Kohanim Goy Kadosh. All the ridiculous news reports, the UN condemnations, and the political pressures that turn Israel upside down into the aggressor or the oppressor, impossibilities. Impossibilities. Assimilation, intermarriage, also non-existent. How could they exist? The clarity of understanding that would be accessible and evident to all would create a situation where no one would even think to sacrifice his or her special heritage at any cost whatsoever. So many things that we yearn for, challenges that we face both in our personal lives and in the world at large. As we say in Musaf on Rosh Hashanah, Kula ke'ashan tichla. It would all disappear if Hashem's malchus was apparent to the world. That's what we mourn on Tisha B'Av. And in truth, it's at the core of almost every line of malchus, the special tefillah of Rosh Hashanah. Okay, so if we yearn, as we're describing, to crown Hashem now for all nations, we need to do it for ourselves first. But how? What does that mean? How are we to understand? Interesting, the lashon of the Gemara is Kedei Shetam Lichuni Aleichem. Could have just said Kedei Shetam Lichuni, coronate me. No, Shetam Lichuni Aleichem. So this is a fresh look, I hope. A new perspective. Let me tell you about a baseball game. It goes back to 1974 between the Philadelphia Phillies and Los Angeles Dodgers. Now, don't worry if you don't follow baseball, if you're not a fan, you'll still be able to appreciate the story. It was the middle of the fourth inning, and the Dodgers were in the field. All of a sudden, a couple of young hippie troublemakers jumped into the outfield and put down an American flag. They began to douse the flag with lighter fluid, gasoline, and then they struck a match. And just as they were about to light the flag on fire, you can watch this, it's on YouTube, of course. Just as they were about to light the flag on fire, at the last minute, out of nowhere, the right fielder, a guy by the name of Rick Monday, ran in and just in the nick of time, scooped up the flag and saved the day. And the perpetrators were arrested and ejected from the stadium. And of course, the crowd goes wild. It was a huge celebration, not just in the stadium right then, but around the country as the story spread. Rick Monday was a national hero. Yes, they even declared Rick Monday Day. No joke. It was a talk of America. Now, this story, admittedly, happened before my time, but as a kid following baseball in the 1980s, I remember reading about it a good 10, 15 years after the event, and it was still a big deal. I was always struck by how Rick Monday was romanticized as this heroic outfielder, even though, to be honest, as a ball player, it wasn't really all that great, and he didn't do that much. But still, America celebrated. Why such a big deal? The answer is because the flag represents something. For the all-American baseball fan and all Americans, our flag represents the liberties that America provides for us, the values of our democracy that we identify with. We describe ourselves as Americans. So what symbolizes America symbolizes us. We're protective of our flag just like we're protective of our own bodies and our identities. America is also a malchus. Do me a favor, let's not focus on the melech for the moment, although without getting too political, one reason why people get so frustrated when a president is lacking is because we expect, and our hope is that our malchus, our melech, our malchus, of course, as we're saying, describes us, and we identify with it, and we personalize it. So we'd like the melech to be exemplary and to do a good job representing us. Kedei shetam lichuni aleichem connotes not just making Hashem king, but at the same time, establishing us, Aleichem, us as his subjects, as members who identify under Hashem's banner, under Hashem's flag, the flag of his Malchus, and all that that represents. Malchus, practically, as Reb Pinchas explains, isn't merely crowning Hashem. It's elevating us, the Jews, by virtue of who our king is and the fact that he, in a sense, represents us. It makes us unique. It establishes our purpose in the world and the practical ramifications, living a Torah lifestyle that is likewise distinctive and distinguishing. Maybe it's not a flag. Maybe it's a badge. It's a badge that we wear on our sleeves. The Malchus of Hashem upon us is no less than our form of national pride. So let me ask you, where and how does every country bespeak and express its national pride? So it's in the national anthem, of course. No coincidence that America's national anthem is all about its flag. Okay, so what is the Jewish national anthem? With great deference to HaTikvah, which is an anthem maybe more for our homeland, it's still relatively new. I think we have to go a little bit further back in history to the beginning of our nationhood. You know what it is? Where else would we look other than the Rosh Hashanah Tefillah itself? What commences the bracha of Malchus? What introduces the whole theme of the day? Look in the Machzor. In my humble opinion, our national anthem is Aleinu L'Shabeach. Aleinu was authored by the Navi Yoshua himself, again, early in our nationhood, and that's where we declare Emes Malkeinu, Efezu Aso. The theme that we have been discussing is the theme of Aleinu at the same time. Hashem did not create us to be like everybody else. We're not the same. We have a different destiny. We have a different purpose. We are unique because Hashem rules over us, and that makes us his subjects. Not just what it does for Hashem, as it were, but what it does for us. We're unique. We are different than every other people on the planet. Thank you, Hashem, for being our king, because it gives us and our lives new meaning. It gives us special significance as your people and a distinct purpose. So we will be different because we are different. We will elevate ourselves because, as we repeat so many times this time of year, Shimcha HaGadol VaHaKadosh, Aleinu Karasa. Again, the Malchus addresses us and who we are. We do not conclude a single prayer without Aleinu because it's our national anthem. The Rokeach refers to it as Shir HaShirim. Rav Haigong, we're told, he would dafka wrap himself in his towels when reciting Aleinu. Most people are busy wrapping up and folding their talus around during Aleinu. He would wrap himself in the talus at Aleinu out of respect for this special tefillah. To close, Aleinu, our national anthem, on Rosh Hashanah, on Yom Kippur, it has a unique, dramatic, climactic melody. I'm not about tefillah, but just to let that reverberate in your head, Shalosam Chalkeinu Kohen. Such a high note we reach in the tefillos when we recite that point, the core of Aleinu. Hashem, you made us unique because we are your subjects. It's the only tefillah where we prostrate ourselves before Hashem other than Shemoneh Esrei. It's the essence of Malchus because it establishes our purpose as the subjects of the Melech Malchei HaMelechim. And it expresses our hope that that Beis HaMikdash can once again serve when it is rebuilt as the broadcasting station for the message of Malchus around the globe that's been silenced for 2,000 years. It's all over Aleinu. L'saken olam b'malchus shakai. What is tikkun olam? Malchus shakai. Chol b'nei basar yikru b'shmacha. All people, all humans will call out in your name. Yakiru v'yedu kol yoshvei sevel. They'll recognize that the only direction to bow is to you, Hashem. V'kablu chulam es ol malchus secha. V'simloch aleihem mehir l'lomboed. Ki ha-malchus shel chohi. Again and again, not just us, but the entire world should appreciate that malchus, that our national anthem should be something, a message that resonates for all of humanity, for the entire globe. In summary, our new appreciation of malchus in this Rosh Hashanah includes 2 points. Number one, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's eternity. Hu Rishon v'Hu Acharon, and I can begin to look at my life and the world and history through the wide-angled lens of the Melech Malchei Melechim. And number two, that there's a hope that that malchus, which is essentially our national pride, which gives us new direction and new purpose and meaning in our lives, will be something that ultimately is appreciated, both aspects, not just by the Jewish people, but v'haya Hashem l'melech al kol ha'aretz, because on that day when the world returns to perfection, v'yom ahu yeh Hashem echad u'shmo echad. Thank you very much. Look forward to learning more with you next week, Mirz Hashem. Have a good evening.